The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome to episode 25 of The Commentary Track. I'm uncompromising motel owner Frank Thompson, your genial host, and I welcome you back to part two of a conversation with author and film historian Joseph McBride. We had a great time last week talking about Howard Hawks and John Ford and Steven Spielberg and Orson Welles, all of whom Joe has written books about. We pick it up this week with a little talk continuing from the Lincoln conversation, and we veer off into the subject of American presidents for a while, and then back to movies. We talk about John Ford and Orson Welles. Joe is the only person I ever knew who both wrote books about Orson Welles and worked with Orson Welles, or was directed by Orson Welles. He's in The Other Side of the Wind, the unfinished Welles film. We talk about The Magnificent Ambersons, which is one of my favorite films in the world, and also a film we would give almost anything to have restored back to what Orson Welles' original intentions for it were. And we talk about many other things. So I hope that you will enjoy this as much as you enjoyed last week's, and I do assume that you listened to last week's, because if you didn't, what in the world are you listening to part two without part one for? Go back and listen to part one. Just put this on pause right now and go back and listen to the first part. You got to do these things properly. There's a sequence to life, you know. All of Joe's books and some DVDs of the movies we talk about will be listed on his page on the website, thecommentarytrack.com. There'll be Amazon links to all of that great material, and I hope that you'll avail yourself of them. You press that Amazon link and you make a book sale for Joe or a DVD sale, and I get a little kickback, and that makes him happy and me happy, and you'll have that wonderful stuff, and you'll be happy, and Amazon will be happy. I think if you just keep going, it'll make the entire world happy. How could it not? So you make one click on an Amazon link, and you make the entire world happy. You'd be insane not to do this. Please, people, have a little compassion. So I hope you'll enjoy part two of my conversation with Joseph McBride, and I will see you on the other side. I was marginally involved in The Alamo, and that came out in 2004, and wrote the tie-in books for it, but I was on the set quite a lot, and thought finally somebody had done the period properly, because nobody else had ever, they always treat it like a Western, they never treat it like the 1830s, and I remember soon after the trailer came out, one of my Alamo Loon buddies said to me, I could never respect a film in which Travis wears a hat like that. I don't know what to say about that. People are going to quibble about what they're going to quibble about. So.
Well, maybe they're fixated on the John Wayne film, which is actually kind of a good film.
I love the film.
You know, I see that as a very personal film. Talk about an auteurist film. It's John Wayne's take on American history.
I know that film backwards and forwards. Yeah. And but the Wayne film, yeah, I love the Wayne film. Mm-hmm. It's totally and completely a work of fiction in every way. I mean, but aren't most historical films from Hollywood's past? I mean, there's very few films that really hold up in terms of total authenticity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't make a film that's a complete docudrama in the sense of just replicating every word people said. I mean, Leon Adell wrote a very good book about the art of biography. He wrote the great Henry James 5-volume work, and he said you shouldn't quote dialogue from the past unless you have a record, contemporaneous record of transcript or a tape recording or a diary or something, you know, written right at the time. Don't quote it as verbatim. Although sometimes people remember things, but the farther back, the later people remember things, the less likely it is that they actually said it, you know.
Sure.
Somebody says 50 years later, he said such and such, you know. Then what you do then is you say that 50 years later, so-and-so remembered Lincoln saying such and such, you know.
Yeah.
So in a historical film, I just take it for granted there's a lot of license as long as it's in the spirit of the thing. But, you know, if there's some gross factual error, I get bothered by that. you know, and I think we should. But, you know, if you look at Shakespeare, who wrote the greatest docudramas ever, and those are in blank verse, and people didn't speak blank verse.
Well, sure.
You know? and also, like Beckett, for example, just got a lot of the history wrong, but it's still a great play and a good film.
Yeah. It seems to be a wrong-headed way of going about looking at these films, because you're never going to find that kind of authenticity in a film.
Yeah.
You've got to look for something else. You've got to look for the spirit of the time or the spirit of the story.
Yeah, that's what we're going for, I think. And I think people get more upset the more recent it is, because they might remember things. But, you know, if you look at Oliver Stone's Nixon, Anthony Hopkins doesn't look like Nixon, but he's terrific in the film.
Yeah.
And that film is actually quite accurate. It's just not what people generally know about Nixon. But sometimes, you know, somebody like Lincoln, everybody has some images of him from childhood or whatever. And like you say, with the voice, they assume that he must have had a deep voice. But, you know, if you look at the historical record, people remarked on his high tenor voice. People said it helped his voice carry in crowds. When you think about the Lincoln Douglas debates, where they had 20,000 people listening without amplification, it's kind of hard to imagine how people could have heard. But apparently, if you had a high voice, it would carry better in a crowd.
Yeah. But, I think Lincoln is partially so memorable to all of us simply because we know his face so well. We know, yeah. I mean, it's this iconic American image, and so he's stuck in our minds more than almost any other. I mean, even George Washington, we only kind of have an image of what he looks like, but yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, there was a funny scene in the movie A Thousand Clowns where Jason Robards and his nephew like to do imitations, and at one point they do Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton imitation, and Chuckles the Chipmunk gets upset and he says, "Nobody knows what they sounded like," and the kid says, "Well, that's the joke."
That's the funny part.
That's the funny part, yeah.
I was actually interviewing, oh shoot, I've done it again, I've forgotten the name.
Barry Gordon?
The guy who wrote the play.
Oh, Herb Gardner.
Herb Gardner.
Yeah.
I was interviewing him when he did that I'm Not Rappaport. With Walter Matthau. I was doing a piece on Matthau for the Hollywood Reporter.
Oh.
And I said to him that he had given me a lifelong catchphrase with that, because
that's the funny part.
He's, yeah, he says, "You missed the funny part, Leo."
Yeah. And yeah, that's great, because Leo is such an idiot. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I've spent a lot of my life saying, "You missed the funny part."
And I misquoted, and yeah. you got it nailed. But that hits a certain truth that, you know, and I also have a theory about period films, which is they're really about today.
Yeah.
And the only reason to make a period film is because we're interested for some reason that affects us today. And, you know, like George Reedy, who was Johnson's press secretary, was a presidential historian, made a very interesting comment. He said, "Why is Lincoln considered the greatest president?" Partly it's because he was great, but partly because he dealt with a problem we still deal with, which is race in America. And we still struggle with this. And so we're deeply interested in him. And we don't really know what Polk or Fillmore or these guys were particularly. Of course, Polk was the guy who stole Mexico or stole the Southwest and Texas from Mexico. But we don't remember the people who dealt with issues that are kind of settled, you know.
Yes.
And so people get fascinated by Lincoln because he's grappling with that. And also Spielberg said it's about a house divided, which we certainly have today. And I think people were fascinated. You know, I thought maybe people would be upset that Lincoln was portrayed as sort of conniving politician, which Gore Vidal certainly shows him as, and he got some flack for that. But people actually love that Lincoln is shown as not a saint, but a guy out there in the trenches hiring three crooked guys to get votes. And somebody said today we would call them lobbyists, you know. But they love the fact, especially in Washington, they love this film maybe too much, because they think Obama says it shows how you have to get dirty to deal in politics. Well, that is true. But Lincoln had a higher cause. The film doesn't quite say that the end justifies the means, but it shows him operating close to the line of ethics to get things done, which is an interesting lesson.
And I think it does show him to some extent, uniting the two parties.
Yeah.
Although there's still a great deal of contention. And that's something that I think most of us dream of the yeah. day when
somebody
we can all work
this.
Together to go forward instead of we seem to be
yeah.
going farther and farther. I was just thinking also the lasting image of Lincoln ties in with what we were talking about with film directors. He created a brand. I don't know that he meant to, but he did. We know his image. We know he dealt with these big issues. He's the Hitchcock of American politics.
Oh, yeah.
He made himself very much a part of our shorthand.
I had an interesting talk once with Frank Capra about Lincoln, who revered Lincoln and uses him as an iconic figure in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, etc. Mm-hmm. And I said Lincoln wouldn't succeed today because he was too homely and all that. And Capra said, no, you're wrong. He must have had great charisma to have succeeded. And he's really right. A lot of politicians are kind of homely, actually. It really doesn't matter. I think we're kind of fooled by looking at handsome, blow-dried politicians like Romney look kind of like a president, but he sure didn't act like one.
And people didn't get elected.
People saw through that, and they didn't vote for him.
Yeah.
But Lincoln had tremendous presence and charisma. I mean, for one thing, he was a giant, you know, literally. But Capra was right that Lincoln had this quality that you need to succeed in politics, which is charisma. And I worked for John F. Kennedy when I was 12. I was a volunteer in his campaign in Wisconsin. And that's considered the moment when politics became show business or vice versa, where they intertwined. But I guess it's always been to some degree show business. Even George Washington, I mean, people talk about what a great figure he cut sitting on a horse and all that. And I'm sure that was part of his appeal, that he looked like a president or, a democratic version of a king, I guess.
But the difference is Kennedy was really the first time that a president came into our households.
Right, a television star.
Yeah, and he had the looks. He had...
Yeah, he had the handsomest.
Whereas before, even Lincoln was seen by a relatively small number of Americans during his lifetime.
Right.
And they saw images of him, they saw paintings and unflattering...
Terrible cartoons.
Terrible cartoons.
Although the film shows that it was a different time where you could just go walk into the White House and meet the president.
Yeah.
Where they'd have open house for a couple hours a day or whatever. You could just literally walk in the door. So people could approach him, but without television and radio, you didn't have the contact. Franklin Roosevelt, with his fireside chats, brought himself into people's homes. But, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, Harrison Engel, who made a documentary.
Oh, yeah. I know Harrison,
Oh, do you? Yeah. On Theodore Roosevelt. And I mentioned Kennedy as the first movie star president. He said, no, Theodore Roosevelt. Because he had found the paper prints of newsreels. Theodore Roosevelt was a big movie star.
Sure.
He was so charismatic and handsome and energetic that the early films would show him all the time in parades, and they'd even go to Africa and show him on safari, and Harrison found all these fabulous films. And so he was the first movie star president. Kennedy precisely was the first TV star president, because Truman was the first president on television, and then Eisenhower used it, but neither one of them really knew how to use television, and Eisenhower actually kind of feared and disliked television to his detriment, but Kennedy thrived on it.
Yeah, and it's always been the cliche that if you were listening to the debate on radio, that Nixon won.
Right.
But if you watched it on TV, Kennedy won.
Yeah, they had surveys showing that was the case, which is astounding. Because I remember watching the first debate, and you knew that Kennedy had just won the election.
Yeah.
Just because of Nixon looked shifty and sweating, and Kennedy looked calm and in command. You know?
Yeah. And
it is like a movie star. And Norman Mailer wrote a great essay in 1960 for Esquire about Kennedy, and he compared him to Gregory Peck, and he said that he was a good actor but not a great actor, and that Gregory Peck always seemed a little uncomfortable in the role, but that was part of what made him interesting. And actually, I think one of the things that makes Kennedy interesting was that I liked the fact in 1960 that he seemed a little above the muck of politics that he had an ironic detachment from the rituals, and Mailer mentions that actually, that Kennedy had a kind of a humorous feeling toward all the vulgarity of campaigning. It didn't come naturally to him. He had to work himself up into shaking hands and all that, but he did it well.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that he seemed smarter than some of the vulgar politicians like Richard Nixon, who, you know, Nixon would always put his hands up in the air and wave his hands above his head. And Kennedy said, that's one thing I'll never do is wave my hands above my head. I like the detachment he had. You know?
Yeah. And it is funny how little things about our presidents either appeal to us or repel us. We were watching the Kennedy Center Honors the other night, and everybody in the room noticed that Barack and Michelle are grooving to the music and seem to be genuinely into the music that they're listening to. Mm. And we thought, yeah, we got a hip president. You know, we got.
I don't think the Nixons,
we like it. You know,
the Nixons wouldn't have done that.
No. Yeah. And even if they did, it wouldn't have come off.
We
would know.
There were moments when certain presidents were embarrassingly awkward, and
yeah.
Nixon had a lot of those. Whereas it's sock it to me on,
yeah,
on laughing. Yes. Although that was kind of funny in a weird way because it was so out of character. You
know? It was. We got Nixon and John Wayne on laughing doing sock it to me.
So. Oh, John Wayne did that too?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
John Wayne appeared in a bunny suit on laughing.
Oh, I vaguely remember that. Yeah. Well, yeah.
We take John Wayne back to John Ford because I think you might be the first person I've ever talked to who actually interviewed John Ford.
Ah.
And he was a notoriously difficult interview. Yeah. What was your experience like?
Well, yeah, I have a tape of talking to Ford, and I recently transferred it onto a CD and listened to it again for the first time since 1970 when I interviewed him. I was 23 years old. I went out to Hollywood for the first time. I was nearly done with my book on Ford that Mike Wilmington and I were doing, and I wanted to meet him, and he still is my favorite director, and I think he's the greatest of all. And so I went out there, and I knew his reputation as being a very difficult person to interview, and I was kind of a green kid from Wisconsin, never been to California. That week I met John Ford, Jean Renoir, and Orson Welles.
Wow.
My three favorite directors in one week, and Peter Bogdanovich. And I also called Hitchcock and asked for an interview, and the hotel gave me his message. He said, sure, come on over, and I didn't get the message in time, so I could have met Hitchcock.
Ooh.
And I kind of thought that every week would be like this in Hollywood, and I didn't realize this was the best week I ever had in Hollywood, and it was all downhill from there. But so I went to Ford's office, and he was very difficult and crusty. Partly, I had written a note to him, and I had spoken to him on the phone from Wisconsin. He was very cordial, and I put after my name County Mayo, which is where my ancestors came from, which I thought was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that he thought that I was actually from County Mayo, so he started asking me what village I was from in County Mayo. That was what he would do. He would ask people about their heritage, and today that's not considered PC, I guess, to ask people where you're from. But when Curtis Hanson met him, he called him Swede. He gave him that nickname. And so I said, well, I don't really remember where my ancestors came from. And Ford was really, first that somebody wouldn't remember this was terrible. But so he thought I'd misled him into thinking I was a real Irishman, mm-hmm. I guess. So he suddenly turned from being cordial to being crusty. But I think he would have been crusty anyway because I was asking him a lot of questions about his old films, and I was kind of asking some sensitive questions about certain political things and some difficult times in his career and trying to get answers to certain questions because a lot about him was mysterious at the time. That's why I wrote my biography later on, which I started the following year and took 30 years to write. But he was stonewalling me most of the time, and he would pretend not to remember a film. I'd mentioned Fort Apache, and he would ask me what that was about. And I asked about The Searchers. He said, well, that was a good film, made a lot of money, and that's the ultimate end, you know. So he was just giving me a hard time. But he said a few things that were actually very profound and interesting. And at the end of the interview, I gave him a book I had put out called Persistence of Vision, and I had dedicated the book to him. And he looked at it with his glasses up, you know, on his forehead, and he had to look like 6 inches from the book to see it. And he said, "Oh, that's sweet." So I could see the other side of Ford shining through. So it was actually a very revealing hour I spent with him. A short time to be with your subject, but invaluable for me because he was such a strange man. He would never give a straight answer to a question. And I found that frustrating at the time, but now I really respect that because he basically wanted you to look at the films and let the films speak for themselves. He didn't want to tell you what the films were about. He wasn't going to sit there and expound on them. And today, a director makes a film and they give 100 interviews and tell you what to think, you know, and they mm-hmm. don't let you make up your own mind. And I think it's much better what Ford did, basically. He just let the films speak for themselves, and I think that's really terrific. And But I learned a lot from his body language and his entire demeanor that was invaluable to help understand this guy, because part of what my challenge was on the book was to understand the man through the films, because the only time he was actually ever candid with us was in his work. Occasionally in an interview he'd say something that was truthful, but almost never. But you know, he wasn't like people who write autobiographies, which are usually lies anyway. But Ford expressed his feelings through his films. And if you're really in tune with the films, you understand how he felt about Lincoln or Ethan Edwards or all these characters and about historical events. So you can understand him through his work. It's a tricky, complicated thing to do because I don't believe in equating an artist with his work just because you like an artist doesn't mean he's going to be a nice guy. For example, Ford was often not a nice guy. He had some very difficult aspects to his personality and also some very kind aspects. He was a very complicated man. Well, what took me so long to do the book was I think I had to mature into understanding that people are complicated and that they don't, your personality doesn't always cohere. I tried to reconcile certain aspects of Ford for a long time, and I couldn't. And I realized you can't reconcile certain things. He could be cruel one moment and kind the next moment, and it's the same man. We all have these different parts in us, and he had more than most, perhaps. And that's what made him a great artist. And I wrote to Richard Nixon, asked him for an interview, because he said that Ford was his favorite director, and I wanted to meet Nixon, who I've always been fascinated by. And he wrote back and said, "I'm writing a book about American foreign policy and I don't have time to meet, but Ford is my hero in every sense of the word, so I'll write you my thoughts." So he sent me a week later a 500-word essay on Ford, which was really fascinating, Nixonian rant on Ford in Vietnam. But it was very fascinating. And he said Ford is America's Tolstoy, and I think he has a really good point there, because Tolstoy was like Ford. He was a deeply conflicted man who, on the one hand, was an aristocrat who wanted to be a peasant, and he was a libertine who wanted to be a saint, and he had all these warring sides to him that could never be reconciled like Ford. And that's why Tolstoy was able to create all these characters in War and Peace, for example, that he was all these people, because if you're an artist, all your characters are a part of you.
Sure.
So he was able to understand everybody from Napoleon to the lowest level of society, because he could relate to all these. And Ford is like that, too, that he has a rich range. You could also compare him to Shakespeare, that he's America's Shakespeare. And he could, he had all these people inside him. So the Ford interview was fascinating and frustrating at the time, but priceless chance to meet him and spend a little time. You know, what I found that was really interesting, too, was he kept saying to his secretary, he seemed kind of nervous, and he kept saying, "Have we heard from the Italian gentleman yet, the gentleman from Italy?" And he kept asking her if a phone call had come through, and I wondered what that was about. And so I looked in his papers for that time, and I found out that he was trying to set up what would have been his last film. Woody Strode, his actor friend, had become a star in Italian Westerns and was trying to set up an Italian Western for Ford to shoot because Ford was no longer bankable in America. And Ford was waiting for a call from Italy whether this project would go through, and the call never came, and he didn't get to make this film. So his career was literally ending as I was sitting there in his office. Mm. Here I was, this kid, asking him about The Searchers and Fort Apache. It must have been very exasperating for him to be having to think about that while he was trying to make another film. And so I was witnessing the end of his career. And at the very end of our interview, he says this very moving thing. He says, you know, I don't know how to answer your questions because all of you people ask the same questions and I don't know the answers. And he said, I'm just a hard-working ex-director, and I'm trying to retire gracefully. So there was this long pause before he said ex-director, which I thought was really moving and a big piece of news that he basically retired in the midst of our interview. And I played that in Ireland recently. I was there earlier this year for the first John Ford Ireland symposium that the Irish Film and Television Academy is going to have every year now, where they're honoring Ford because he's their cultural icon, even though he wasn't born there. He's an Irish American. So I gave the keynote address, and I played parts of that tape for the first time in public, and I played that moment, and it was very, very touching, I thought.
There's always that dichotomy about Ford that his films are so beautiful, deliberately made, sense of composition like nobody, and so filled with emotion and such often sweet emotion, and almost nobody you talk to who knew him saw much of that in his day-to-day life, because he was apparently could be just a terrible taskmaster on his sets.
Yes and no. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who knew him, like my friend Harry Carey Jr., who just died, a wonderful man.
Just died 2 days ago as we speak.
Yeah, and I knew him well, and he had made 11 films with Ford and wrote a wonderful book on Ford, Company of Heroes, which I recommend. Yes. It's just the best portrait of Ford at work. He really gets it down perfectly, and it's a hysterically funny book, too. It'll make you roll on the floor, but full of truth. But Ford, the paradox of Ford was he could be the sweetest, kindest man in the world and then the most terrible sadist. Dobie Carey told me, he said he was driving on location in Monument Valley with Victor McLaughlin. He was sitting in the back of the station wagon, and McLaughlin was in the front. And McLaughlin turned around and said, "Laddie," he says, "you've never worked with Ford before, have you?" He said, "Well, actually, I did 3 Godfathers." Said, "Oh, okay." He said, "Just one thing you got to remember about Ford. He's a sadist. He's a sadist." And there was this moment where on 3 Godfathers, Harry Carey Jr. was doing a scene with Pedro Armendariz and John Wayne where they were supposed to be waking up after a sandstorm and looking for their horses that had run away, and Harry Carey Jr. wasn't looking in the right direction. Ford picked up a rock and threw it at his head, and he ducked, and it hit Pedro Armendariz in the cojones. But Dobie said, you know, if it hit me in the head, he might have killed me. You know, he was kind of shocked that Ford would do this, and Pedro luckily survived, but that's pretty severe. He also, one time, Dobie was, they were doing a fight scene on Two Road Together, and between takes, Dobie was lying on the ground kind of catching his breath, and Ford didn't like that. So he went over and knelt on his chest and broke 3 of his ribs.
Wow.
So he did that, and this is a guy he loved and thought he was like his son. But he would be very kind and sweet to him on other occasions, too. And he saw all sides of him, and that comes across in the book. But he could be very charming and funny. And his mother, Harry's mother, Olive Carey, who knew Ford longer than anybody else that I ever met, said the whole thing was a big act. She said he was the greatest actor of all time, that he put on this act of this director who is this, you know, tyrant and kind of a father figure, you know, he was like an abusive father who could be nice sometimes and abusive other times. And she said it was all a big act. Underneath it, she said he was a pussycat. She said he was the most vulnerable, sensitive guy, but he didn't want people to see that, and that's a key to his personality. And his daughter Barbara said that's why he wore those dark glasses, so you couldn't see his sensitive eyes. She said they would have killed him in Hollywood if you could have seen how sensitive he was. Mm. So he put on this whole thing to protect himself from people understanding his sensitivity, which was, in his time, regarded as suspect. It was either effeminate or you were an artist. And if you run around Hollywood saying you're an artist in those days, like Sternberg and Welles did, they killed you. You know? Yeah. So Ford pretended that he was an illiterate cowboy, as he said to Hedda Hopper. He said, "Don't let this get around. I present myself as an illiterate." You know.
Yeah, that's why all those guys went hunting all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, so Ford had this big act that he put on. But, you know, when you play a role for a long time, it sort of becomes you after a while, too.
You know, I worked a lot with Shirley Jones on various projects, and she once told me a story about, on the set of Two Road Together, Ward Bond died during production of that film.
Oh, yeah.
And Ford flew back to Hollywood for the funeral, and when he came back to the set, Shirley said that they could see they were down on the Alamo set that John Wayne built in Brackettville, and they could see the car coming from half a mile away. Hmm. So they all lined up to greet him, and she said he got out of the car and he was bent over wearing a dark suit and dark glasses, and he'd come straight from the funeral flown right back, and he said he looked very old and very sad, and he sort of went down the line greeting everyone. And when he got to Andy Devine, he said, "Well, now you're the biggest jackass in the world."
Yeah, I had heard that story a little differently. I was talking to Henry Brandon, who played Chief Scar in The Searchers, and he was in the film. And he said he was there the day that Ward Bond's death was revealed. You know, and he said he saw Ken Curtis, who was Ford's son-in-law, go over to him and with Wingate Smith, his brother-in-law, and they were telling him something important. And Henry Brandon said, "I'm a nosy guy, so I went over to listen." And they were telling him Ward Bond had just died. And he said Ford turned to Andy Devine and said, "Now you're going to have to be my horse's ass now." So maybe he used that line again because he liked it so much.
But then, he refined it.
Yeah. But then Chuck Hayward told me, he was one of the stuntmen on the film.
Sure.
He said that underneath Ford's dark glasses, he saw a tear coming out as he made that joke, you know?
Well, I always saw that as a hilarious and sad story.
Yeah.
Because he apparently mercilessly ragged on Ward Bond his entire life.
Yeah.
And yet they were lifelong friends. I mean, they were very, very close friends. And
yeah, he had very conflicted views because Ward Bond was one of the leaders of the blacklist in Hollywood, as you know.
Yeah.
And Henry Brandon said to me, he said Ward Bond and Hedda Hopper ran the blacklist. And he said, you know, in Texas in the old days, if you took a man's horse, you'd get hung, he said. And yet Ford was against the blacklist most of the time, although, you know, he wavered on occasions. But so he hated Bond's, you know, Neanderthal politics. But he could accept him as a friend. He was a great actor. And as Henry Brandon perfectly said, Ward was a great actor and he was a shit.
Yeah.
And that's true of a lot of movie people. They're great directors and they were shits, you know. Yeah,
and even Wayne was exasperated with Ward Bond's points of view on.
He was too extreme for John Wayne.
Yeah.
But they were both in the Motion Picture Alliance together. But Ward Bond was, Anna Lee said to me, she thought that Ford didn't respect Ward Bond very much and he would humiliate him and do all kinds of terrible things to him and treat him like a lackey and, you know. And I found an amazing story that Barbara Ford said that when Ward Bond died, Ford would always give his cronies a big send-off at the John Ford Chapel at the Motion Picture Home, and they had his body lying in state, and they had a huge funeral. But the night before the funeral, she said somebody stole Ward Bond's body for a few hours, and then it came back. So so maybe his enemies in Hollywood decided to take revenge. That must, Ford must have been freaked out by then.
Wow. What if that's true?
Well, yeah, she's a pretty reliable source, yeah. And I found that. Yeah, he was a character, and, you know, I've always thought he was one of the best actors in Hollywood. I did a book called The Book of Movie Lists, and I had a list of five actors who have never been bad. And I had Lillian Gish, Gene Hackman, and I'm forgetting who all they were, but I put Ward Bond in the list, and he's always good, you know.
I would agree. He's always terrific.
He made so many films and so many little, and not always the same kind of part. Sometimes he was a bad guy, sometimes a good guy, but he's just terrific all the time.
Yeah, and also capable of showing a great, expansive spirit, and it's always hard for me to jibe that guy with the stories I hear about his private life, which makes him just sound like an awful man. But
yeah, and there's these letters I found from Ford in World War II to his wife, making fun of Ward Bond for being shirking war duty, although he was an epileptic and he had reasons for not going into the service. But he and Wayne could have gone in, you know, and Ford didn't have a lot of respect for these two guys for not serving their country. They were air raid wardens, and Ford would write jokes about Ward and Duke sitting on the hilltop in Hollywood with tin hats on watching for the Japanese bombers. But so Ford didn't have a lot of respect for him. But he's just, you know, you love his characters in Wagon Master and Fort Apache. And he had great humanity, and yet he was such a horrible guy. It's just, it's part of the paradox of art that people, and that's something I deal with a lot as a biographer, that people have this very simplistic view that if you love the artist, you're going to love the guy. And as I've mentioned before, that's not always true. And a lot of the greatest artists are very troubled human beings. That's where the art comes from. If you look at Hemingway or Mozart or Tolstoy, these are guys you wouldn't necessarily want to live with, you know?
Yeah. It's always a cautionary phrase, you know, be careful not to to meet the people you admire, you know?
Yeah. There's an old phrase could apply to a number of these people. As an artist, nobody could touch him. As a man, nobody'd want to touch him.
Well, Orson Welles was apparently a much more accessible spirit. You knew him quite well.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Tell me a little bit about working with him. I didn't even realize that you were in Other Side of...
The Wind.
Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah.
In the early 70s, I'm trying to remember exactly what year this was, but I was living in Boston. I was in college in Boston, and there was an Orson Welles cinema in Cambridge.
Oh, yeah.
And Orson Welles and Peter Bogdanovich came there.
I've seen footage of that. Somebody filmed it. Yeah.
And I was there. And
you were there. Huh?
And they showed clips of that film, and they said it was going to be finished any time now, and it was going to be coming out.
I've been hearing that for 40 years.
Yeah, still waiting, 40 years later. But I didn't realize that you were in it. But you knew Welles already before this.
Well, I met him that week, because when I went to Hollywood to interview Ford, I called Peter Bogdanovich because I admired him, and I kind of wanted to be like him because he was interviewing all the people I liked, and then he was making films, and I had that aspiration.
Sure.
So I got his phone number and called him, and he said, "I'm on the other line with Orson. Could you hold on?" And I said, "Wow." And he said, he came back and said, "Orson would like to meet you. Could you call him tomorrow at this number?" And I said, "Hey, sure." And I had no idea Welles was in town. It was the last place I thought I'd meet Welles, because he was always in Europe at that time. And I would be sending him chapters from my book that I published in magazines. I sent him through his lawyer in New York, and I had no idea if he had seen them, but in fact he had. And so I called Welles, and the first thing he said was, "We're about to start shooting a film. Would you like to be in it?" And I was completely floored, because I'd never acted before, unless you count being an altar boy, which is a form of acting, I realized.
Sure.
Although I had my back to the audience and spoke in a monotone and spoke Latin and couldn't vary the movements. But so I said a very stupid thing. I said, is this going to be a feature-length film? Because I couldn't imagine he'd put me in a feature. And he laughed and said, well, we certainly hope so. And actually, that was a good question because it's still not a feature-length film, and we're still hoping.
Sure.
But so I went to see him and spend a few hours with him and got to ask him a lot of questions. And then the next day we started shooting, or actually 2 days later. And we shot for a whole day with Peter Bogdanovich and I playing a couple of film critics. I play a film critic called Mr. Pister. We all have sort of Dickensian names in the film. And I follow John Huston around, who's this legendary director trying to make a comeback in Hollywood in what we now call the Easy Rider era. And it's all these young people have taken over Hollywood, and he's this old John Ford, Ernest Hemingway kind of guy who's macho, blowhard, who's a great filmmaker, but he's out of touch with the current scene. But he's trying to make a film that's hip and full of radical chic violence and nudity. So it's Welles' satire on the changing Hollywood, which is fascinating because it was right at that time when everything was changing. And so I follow him around. I'm supposed to be doing a book about him, and I ask him a lot of intrusive film buff questions that get him angry all the time. And so I was in this film for 6 years because Welles kept calling me back for more shooting. And he was making it mostly with his own money, and then he unfortunately sold half the film to the Shah of Iran's brother-in-law, which proved to be a mistake because when the Shah fell, the Ayatollah took over and sent agents around the world looking for the property of the royal family, which included The Other Side of the Wind. And so Welles had to hide the negative in a wine cellar of a French restaurant outside Paris. And so for many years, Mr. Boucherie, Mehdi Boucherie, the Shah's brother-in-law, and Welles were feuding over the ownership of the film because Welles kept needing more money and Boucherie kept taking a higher percentage, and Welles apparently only owned like 20% of the film by the end. So there was this tremendous stalemate, and then Welles died, and Oya Kodar, his companion and collaborator in the film, inherited his ownership. And so Gary Graver, the cameraman, and I worked out a deal finally where Boucherie and Oya would each take 50% of the film, and that was a big step in the right direction. Then we made a deal with Showtime in 1999 to finish the film. And then Peter Bogdanovich and Oya fired me because they didn't need me anymore. And I decided to just not contest it, even though it was unfair, but I didn't want to do anything to hamper the film. And then the deal immediately fell apart. And I think if they had kept me on the film, the film would have been out years ago because I could have gotten it done. And I had a lawyer who was willing to work on the film pro bono to sort out the legal battles, and we were going to try to finish the editing. The film is virtually all shot. It just needs two or three shots that could be done in CGI or post-production. But it's all sitting in a lab in Paris. It's a long story, but people have been trying to finish it ever since. But I bowed out of it when I was fired, and I'm still kibitzing the production. There's a friend of mine, Josh Karp, is writing a book about the film, which should be terrific. He's interviewed everybody, and he's found people I didn't even know were involved in the film, and he's gotten to the bottom of all these Byzantine financial things. So it's really sort of the most legendary unfinished film, and I don't know if it'll ever be finished. It seems crazy that this film is not out, and some people think it's too hard to edit it, and some people think we shouldn't edit it because Welles is not around. He edited 41 minutes of it, so we'd have to finish it in a style that approximates his, which only he could really do.
Sure.
And, you know, if he were here today, he would have, he kept changing his mind all the time about every project and re-editing films, and who knows what he would, how he'd approach it today. But so you'd have to make a educated guess about how to finish it. But, you know, I'm not a professional editor. I could edit the film, you know. I mean, I wouldn't do as well as Walter Murch or somebody like that. But, you know, if we hired a real editor to do the film and had people advising about Welles' intentions, the film could be put together in quite a nice way. And it may not be, it wouldn't be Citizen Kane. I mean, it has some character. I realized it has some story problems, I think. There's some script problems, which usually are what cause films to have problems. But it's still quite a remarkable film stylistically and historically, and it's got all these amazing people in it. And Wells was experimenting visually in a lot of ways. It would really be interesting for people to see it. But whether it'll ever come out, I have no idea. There are a few people left from the film, but I'm one of the last people, and I expect that maybe in the year 2038 I'll hobble into some theater in Westwood with my walker for the premiere. But I hope it'll happen before then.
Yeah, I hope so too. I still vaguely remember the clips we saw that day. And
in Boston. Yeah, he showed clips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
you can see some on YouTube. Occasionally they come and they go. Also, on the American Film Institute Life Achievement Award show in 1975, he presented two clips that he had edited, and tapes of that are floating around. Also, the film The One Man Band, which is on the Criterion DVD of F for Fake, is a very good German documentary about Wells' unfinished work. And they have some clips, wonderful clips, from The Other Side of the Wind and other. Wells made a lot of films in his later years. I knew him the last 15 years of his life, which was basically when he came back from Hollywood, or to Hollywood from Europe, spent most of his time in Hollywood until he died in 1985. And the conventional wisdom, which I wrote a book to attack called Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, was that he was this fat guy who sat around eating and drinking and making wine commercials, and that's about it, and occasionally appearing in some bad film. What people didn't know and the media didn't care about was that he was shooting films all the time with his own money. He had turned his back on the studios because he had given up on them. And he was trying to make films completely independently. And he earned a lot of money making commercials and acting in films, and he funneled most of it into his own productions. So he was a truly independent filmmaker. And my friend Doug Gomery, who's a film historian, was the first person who pointed out that Wells was always an independent filmmaker from the beginning, and that people mistakenly think of him as a failed studio filmmaker because he started with a couple of films for RKO and got fired. But Gomery says he was an independent filmmaker who just briefly used the resources of major studios to make experimental films. And then he had to go to Europe during the blacklist period. I think he was blacklisted, and he was gone throughout the whole most of the 50s and came back briefly and worked in Europe after that. But he was scrambling for money all the time, but he wound up just making literally home movies in his own house with his own money. But he was shooting every day with some new project. He always had several projects going, and he did a lot of fascinating stuff. A lot of it was not finished for a variety of reasons. He was up against, as he said, the most expensive art form there is. If you're a painter, all you need is a box of paints. But he needed money, and actors would come and go and this and that. But the Munich Film Museum has his unfinished films, and they've been putting together DVDs of compilations of things like The Dreamers was a project he worked on for years, and there's a wonderful 27-minute condensed version of it that plays really well, actually, even though it's not the whole film. And there are a lot of these things, but they're not available commercially on DVD. They're shown in film festivals. They're concerned about, Wells's youngest daughter, Beatrice, keeps threatening lawsuits every time somebody puts out one of her father's films. So she's managed to kind of poison the well. Otherwise, we'd be seeing all these films. So you have to see them in archives and festivals, usually.
Yeah.
Other Side of the Wind, she really has no ownership of, but it's been held up by all these other feuds and squabbles between people who are involved in the film and everything like that, you know.
Yeah, so much stuff that it would be so wonderful to see. But of course, Magnificent Ambersons is the one that I would most like to see.
Well, I have this
put back together.
I have this dream that I want to go find it because And I keep saying this, and I've got to do this. I want to mount an expedition to Brazil with Bill Krohn, who's the Hollywood correspondent of Calle do Cinema, who co-directed the wonderful documentary It's All True, based on an unfinished film by Orson Welles, where they reconstructed the last part of It's All True and other parts of it. But RKO sent the rough cut down to Welles in Brazil, and this was the version that was 131 minutes long that was previewed unsuccessfully in the studio, hacked it up and cut 50 minutes out of it and reshot parts of it. But Welles had the print down there in Brazil, and there's documentary evidence that it was sent back and destroyed, and they destroyed all the negative outtakes. But when I met Bogdanovich in 1970, he showed me a folder full of what seemed like 50 or maybe 100 frame enlargements from the missing scenes. And I saw the last shot, for example, which nobody's ever seen. And I said, where did you get these? And he just wiggled his eyebrows. And I asked him many years later, where did you get them? He said, Orson had them made. So I thought, well, when did Orson have these made? He had to have them made in either in Brazil or in Hollywood. Maybe he brought the film back to Hollywood. And why did he have them made? Because these were scenes that he knew were cut. So it made me think, at some point, the film, Welles held onto the film. And Bill Krohn thinks that the order to destroy the film was actually not carried out, that Welles may have had the film in Brazil, and he may have left it there with Bill has some clues about where it might be in Brazil or might have been. So I want to go down there and just look for it in the vaults. And who knows what we'll find, because, you know, strange films have turned up. Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc turned up in a Danish mental hospital, you know, the original cut. And John Ford's Upstream was found down in New Zealand with some other American films. And so there are these films out there. And so I'm thinking it'd be a real something I should do is go there with Bill and I have a student down there, and I want to make a documentary of us getting in a canoe and paddling around looking for this film. And maybe just we might open the can and find it's all decayed, unfortunately.
Yeah. And,
but Bill has this concern that he believes there's a voodoo curse on Orson Welles, as you may have heard that voodoo witch doctors were upset with Welles and they put a curse on him.
That would explain a lot.
I don't believe in curses, but Bill actually hired a voodoo priestess to remove the curse from Orson Welles. She went through this big ceremony and she said, "I'm sorry, I can't remove the curse. It's too strong and it's too deep."
Wow.
And people have said, well, his career seems cursed. My take, and I said this in whatever happened to Orson Welles, and I was criticized by people, but I think it's right. The real curse of his career was capitalism. And, you know, he was an artist, experimental artist, who worked in a commercial capitalist art form that was antithetical to his themes, because he was always challenging whatever establishment he was up against. Like in Brazil, he was against the Brazilian government and the American government, who combined with RKO to destroy his film. And he was experimenting with their money, and they didn't like that. And that's what blighted his career to some extent. But I think of him as a hero, that he kept shooting his own films by hook or by crook, regardless. And he was like a student filmmaker, avant-garde filmmaker, like a Stan Brakhage, who would just go out and shoot films with his own money and do it the way he wanted. And today, could you imagine, you know, with digital stuff, if he had all you need today is a camera, you could make, he'd be shooting films every day.
Yeah.
He'd be shooting King Lear, he'd be doing this and that. And
he could use his iPhone.
Yeah. It would be just wonderful if he were around today making all those films. But I want to go and try to make an effort to find Ambersons. I think we owe that to film history. Somebody did an article about that in Vanity Fair a few years ago about the legend that Ambersons may survive. Somebody actually wrote a novel about that as well.
Oh, yeah?
Called The Cutting Edge. It's not very good, but it claims that Welles had the film and he left it in a taxi cab down there and lost it. I regret never asking him about that print. you know.
Yeah. But you suppose he would have been forthcoming if you had?
Yeah, I think he would have. It was a very painful subject. Maybe that's why I talked to him briefly about the film. But it was. I can't imagine how he continued after what happened to that film. He makes probably the greatest film ever made, and it's eviscerated.
Yeah, even as it is now, it's one of the greatest films I've ever seen.
Still my favorite film. Yeah. And people ask me, how could it be your favorite film if 50 minutes of it are missing? And I said, well, the first 30 minutes of that film are the best film I've ever seen. And then there are great moments throughout the rest of it, even though it gets very choppy. But it's just a marvelous film. And so I didn't really get to probe him on that. I talked to Robert Wise a lot, who did the editing, and Wells blamed him.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
For that, although other people... I mean, I think it's more complicated than just Robert Wise. He was a studio functionary.
Well, Wise, I worked with Wise on a book as well, and he was always fairly matter-of-fact about it when I talked with him about it, but because his attitude was always, hey, you know, most people think it's a great film now, so at least we got it out, you know.
Yeah.
But he was not, I mean, it wasn't like Robert Wise came in and took the film over.
No.
He just worked it. He was the editor at RKO, and they just, you know, he wanted to become a director, and he actually did direct a scene.
Yeah, Wells' take on it, he told me, was that Robert Wise used that to become a director.
Yeah.
There is some truth to that.
Did, yeah.
But Wise was a very nice man. I liked him, and that's another paradox that he did this thing where he destroyed my favorite film, but he was following orders, which, as we know in the Nuremberg trials, we punish people very severely for doing that. But his attitude, and I think he was quite sincere, was that he said we were faced with a problem film that wasn't playing with audiences, and we had to save the film. And he actually felt they had saved the film from being unreleasable.
Yeah.
And from his Hollywood point of view, I could see what he's saying. However, he admitted that it was a better film than the original version, but the audience, he said, if you had been at that preview in Pomona, you would know what I'm talking about. It was the worst time in my life, people laughing at the film. But they showed it with a musical to a teenage audience on a Friday night, and it was or Saturday night, and it was, you know, designed to fail.
Yeah.
And I found the smoking gun, I believe, in Wells' entire career is a transcript of a telephone conversation between two RKO executives when Wells was in Brazil shooting It's All True. This happened at the same time. And they were saying, we're not telling Wells what the real budget of It's All True is because the film is a disaster and we want to call him back and there's no film there and we want to just cut it up to use his stock footage. But we're not going to tell him that. Basically, he was $400,000 under budget when he was fired. And they fired him for being over budget and being profligate, which he was not.
Mm.
And I have all the papers that show what the original deal was with the U.S. government, paid for most of the film, and RKO paid for part of it. And they lied to him, and they admitted in this phone conversation, we're lying to him, and we're not telling him what the truth is about this film, and then they fired him. And so they were out to destroy his career. And there was an interview with Reg Armour, who is George Schaefer's right-hand man at RKO, who hated Wells. A lot of people hated Wells, and they thought he was this kind of radical, leftist, experimental guy who came to Hollywood to mess with their way of doing things. And Reg Armour said Reg Armour said the RKO board was against Wells from the very beginning. You know, George Schaefer wanted him, and nobody else wanted him there, and they were out to get him from the beginning. You know, and Kane was almost destroyed and burned, as we know. That there was, Robert Wise told me this great story that, you know, the Louis B. Mayer had put together a consortium of Hollywood studios that were going to pay RKO the cost of Kane so they could burn the negative to appease Hearst. And Wells was sent to New York to a screening room at the Radio City Music Hall to show the film to the heads of the corporations in New York that ran the studios, and their top lawyers were all at this little screening. And Robert Wise was there, and he said Wells gave the greatest performance of his life, where he got up and gave a speech about freedom of speech and freedom of the arts at a time when Hitler was running rampant through Europe and destroying all of our freedoms. And and our freedoms were in jeopardy, and we should not buckle under to Hearst and the studios, and we should release this work of art. And they were so moved, these business guys and lawyers, that they let him release the film. But it came that close that they were going to burn the film that is often considered the greatest film of all time.
And after all that, then it seems kind of miraculous that he was able to make Amberson's at all.
Yeah, and he had done that on the radio, and he played George Schaefer the recording. And Schaefer fell asleep listening to the recording, which should have been a dangerous sign. But Schaefer said, go ahead and make the film. But it was more expensive than they planned, although it was still under $2 million. It was, it was a expensive film, but not a, not going to break the bank. But RKO was in financial trouble at the time, and they were worried about going back into receivership. And Wells was considered this guy who was always pushing them to spend more money. Like, Kane was originally going to cost $500,000, cost $759,000, which is really pretty cheap when you compare it with a film like Gunga Din or something.
Sure.
But, they let him do Amberson's, and then they started having second thoughts. And then he did the real ending, this very bleak ending in a boarding house, which nobody's ever seen, because they cut it off the film. And I'm told he shot it secretly. It's not in the script. He shot it over a weekend when they weren't aware what he was doing. And then they saw this, and it was a very dark film. There's a fellow named Roger Ryan, who's a Wells aficionado, who's done his own reconstruction of Amberson's. He uses stills from the missing scenes, and we have the dialogue. We know what the dialogue is because there was a cutting continuity, and he had him and his friends read the dialogue and played the Bernard Herrmann music that was cut. And it's amateurish in the best sense of the word, that Roger is not a professional filmmaker, but it's a labor of love, and he and his wife and friends did the stuff. And they don't try to imitate Orson Welles, or I'm sorry, Agnes Moorehead or anybody. They just do the lines. And actually, I think that's nice. It actually works well. And when you see this, it's astonishing because it's such a different film. It's a very, very dark film, and very moving and very Chekhovian, and it's a lot different from the version we have today. And if we could just get that film out, it would probably become the greatest film ever.
Wow, how I would love to see that.
Well, I'm going to try.
Yeah.
But I should show you.
Let me know. I'll get in that canoe with you.
Yeah, we'll get in that canoe, and we'll have her go down the Amazon and look for the film.
Well, I should probably get in my own canoe now. We've been talking on, and I could continue for about three more hours.
We could go on for weeks.
Yeah.
This is great.
Let's do it again one of these days.
Yeah, so much stuff, and it's great talking to you about films.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate your doing this with me, and let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, it's my great pleasure, and I love your show, and I'm honored to be on it, and thank you for coming and talking about all these things.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Let's do another one. Yeah.
Okay,
thank you.
I sure hope you enjoyed part two of my talk with Joe McBride, and I really hope, as I told him in the interview, that we will do this again, and you'll hear more from him sometime in the future, because we got lots more to talk about, especially if I do follow him against his will to that trip down to Brazil to see if we can find the original print of Magnificent Amberson's. Wouldn't that be cool? I'll definitely come back and talk about that. How could I not? It would be interesting. And it would be historic. It would be interesting and historic. As I said, all of his books and DVDs of some of the films we talked about are listed on his page on the website, thecommentarytrack.com. I hope you'll go there for all your Joseph McBride needs. You might also go to my own page on that website for books and videos, and order all those things that you might want to read or watch that I had something to do with. And if there's a price on it, that means that you can order directly from me. I'll autograph it, or not autograph it if you prefer to keep it pristine. And if there's no price, that just has an Amazon link, so just go through Amazon. And I'll get a little bit of a kickback. It's not exactly like you buying it directly from me, but it's something. And I believe something is better than nothing. And I might even write a song to that effect one of these days. So please do that. So we'll get a little bit of a kickback. Use that Amazon link through my website as often as you can, because everybody buys everything from Amazon, right? I urge you to buy a house, maybe even a canoe, a helmet of some sort. Anything you can get through Amazon. So whenever you do it, go through the commentarytrack.com website, and I'll get a kickback, and soon I'll be richer than old Midas, and maybe even as rich as Scrooge McDuck. So I hope that you will help me out there. I forgot last week to thank all the people involved in helping get this podcast up, and I was remiss in forgetting them. So let me thank them twice this time. Thank you to my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough Thompson, for being my announcer. Thanks to James Hutchins, who not only designed the Commentary Track website, but my personal website, frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll go there. My latest holiday letter is up on the personal website. I will modestly say that my holiday letters have a certain amount of following. I do get a bit of grief if I'm late on putting them out. Let's just say they're a bit more lunatic than they are Christmassy. But I hope that you'll read the latest one. There are some other ones from past years up there still. I especially want to thank Gary Rand and Rob Clearfield, who wrote my wonderful theme music, Fore and Aft. And you're listening to some of that right now. It's lovely stuff. And I treasure them both for contributing such wonderful music to my podcast. And I treasure each and every listener. And I hope you'll spread the word. Please use the social media to let other people know about the podcast. And go to iTunes and leave a good review. Leave a 5-star rating. And also write something down. I really would love to get some more responses on there, because it brings more ears to the podcast. And I really want to build an audience with this thing. And you can help. And I hope that you will. So that wraps up another one. We'll be back next week. I hope that you will be with me again then. And until then, don't worry. We'll fix it in post.